24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs, such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
It is Monday, August the 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, dual terror attacks in Spain might have been more catastrophic.
It does appear that there were at least 120 gas cylinders that had been collected one by one over a period of as long as 12 months in that bomb-making factory.
U.S. President to announce his Afghan policy.
I imagine that it will wisely also include a focus on what the U.S. policy will be in Pakistan, and that's wise.
And solar eclipse fever, can you believe it? Plus a 70s superstar, it's all ahead. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. The Catalan government in Spain says the jihadist cell, which carried out twin vehicle attacks in Barcelona and a seaside town, has been neutralized, in their words, even though one of the attackers remains on the run. At least 14 people were killed and more than 100 injured in the attacks in which vehicles were used to plow into pedestrians on Barcelona's most popular street and in the community of Cambrils, both attacks claimed by the Islamic State. Police suspect that at least 12 people have involvement in those attacks, many of them Moroccans. Investigators are hunting for Younes Aboukyaab, a 22-year-old Moroccan, with unconfirmed reports suggesting he might have been the Barcelona van driver. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Deakin University's chair in global Islamic politics, Greg Barton, if Europe is facing a big problem right now in light of the ongoing jihadist attacks.
Europe certainly has a big problem. The Polo car the attackers were using in Cambrils was sighted in Paris. France has literally 10 times more foreign terror fighters going out than Spain. But Spain's seen a very large number of arrests, at least 173 in the last 4 years, and that might be one reason why we've not seen a successful jihadi terror attack in Spain since 2004 up until, of course, the Barcelona attack.
There are also jihadi recruiting centers in places like Belgium.
Yes, Belgium and France have particular problems. Britain is close behind in terms of rates of recruitment. Spain is not immune from these problems, particularly Catalonia, where there are links with northern Morocco, and that seems to be a particular issue in terms of recruitment. It's all about social networks, of course. But Spain up until now has been able to keep on top of the problem, whereas France and Belgium have been struggling. France particularly struggles from prison radicalization. 60% of the prison population is thought to be Muslim, and many people who fall into the hands of recruiters do so in prison, where they go in for drug or theft charges and end up joining a gang. So it's a challenge all across Western Europe, but the level of attacks that we've seen in Northwestern Europe outweighs the problems that Southern Europe has experienced up until now.
Do you directly tie this to the migration problems of the last 2 years?
No, there doesn't seem to be any particular links to the last 2 years of migration. A typical pattern we find around the world, this includes even as far away as Australia, is it's second-generation Muslim youth who are targeted and recruited by ISIS or even al-Qaeda recruiters. ISIS has particularly been effective in targeting younger people, but almost invariably they've grown up in the country or born in the country where they were recruited and have not been the product of recent migration. And typically they tend not to have much religious knowledge, which probably makes them more plastic, more impressionable for skillful recruiters. So it's not by and large linked to recent recruitment. ISIS has tried to use refugee flows at points more as a psychological warfare tool than an actual logistical tool. So the November 13, 2015 attack in Paris, one of the suicide bombers was carrying a Syrian passport, or at least what appeared to be a Syrian passport, was probably fake. But that seems to have been deliberately planted just to play into this psychological aspect of terror linked to refugee flows. In actual fact, the individuals being recruited have largely grown up in the countries where they're recruited, and they launch attacks in neighborhoods familiar to them.
The house where this suspect or these suspects have been living was in Catalonia. And of course, Catalonia has been involved in separatist movement for quite some time. Any linkage there, or is this purely an Islamic State operation?
It's purely an Islamic State operation. The only very indirect linkage is that because of Spain's history of both fascism and regional separatism in places like Catalonia, today's democratic Spain is reluctant to have a heavy police presence on the ground, particularly in Catalonia. There's a sense of treading lightly and not reminding people of the horrors of the past. And that might have indirectly contributed to the fact that this terror cell flew under the radar, a terror cell as strong as at least a dozen people, flew under the radar for 12 months. And that's a significant intelligence failure, so it would appear, in a country that otherwise has been pretty much on top of this problem. And it may relate to particular tensions in Catalonia and a cautious response from police not to be seen to be too heavy-handed.
Well, Greg, police on Sunday said they uncovered a cache of gas canisters at the house believed to be the bomb-making factory of the suspects in those attacks. Apparently, we averted an even more catastrophic attack.
Yeah, it does appear that there were at least 120 gas cylinders that had been collected one by one over a period of as long as 12 months in that bomb-making factory. It appears also that we're making TATP, triacetone triperoxide, an infamous homemade explosive of choice by ISIS, used in Paris, used in Brussels, used in the Manchester attack. And the combination of the two elements and the fact that they were trying to rent a truck, they were not successful at the last minute with the Barcelona attack due to lack of paperwork, suggests they may have been targeting some of the famous tourist sites, including the cathedral in Barcelona. And had they been able to execute their plans as they wished, the death toll literally may have been an order of magnitude larger. We may have been dealing with hundreds of people killed, rather than just over a dozen.
How do European authorities combat this kind of tactic?
Well, the first line of defense always is intelligence, and that depends not just intercepting communications and using technology, but working with communities and getting a heads up when people have concerns about friends or loved ones who they think are coming out of the sway of radical recruiters. Now, there were some warning signs in hindsight with some people in this terror cell, but of course they fit a typical profile of kids who seemed unremarkable and not particularly religious. But those close to them notice strange absences or new friendships or sudden adherence to new ideas. And that reliance on human intelligence has served Europe well. It has been largely successful in stopping the vast majority of attempted attacks. Even in Spain, no jihadi attacks between 2004, the Madrid train bombings, and this attack in Barcelona. But of course, as the old adage goes, the terrorists only have to get it right once. Those fighting them have to get it right every single time.
That's Greg Barton. He is the chair in global Islamic politics at Deakin University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump plans to address the nation later today. In fact, tonight, on his strategy for the war in Afghanistan, he and his national security team met Friday to reach agreement on a strategy. The president then tweeted over the weekend that he had made a decision. We asked Wilson Center South Asia scholar Michael Kugelman what might be expected from President Trump's remarks.
Well, I think that he's going to come out with a plan, above all, to guide the future U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. Now, I imagine that it will wisely also include focus on what the U.S. policy will be in Pakistan. And that's wise, as I say, because it's very hard to consider ways forward in Afghanistan without looking at the very connected case of Pakistan, which is a bordering country of Afghanistan and also happens to play a key role in the war in Afghanistan because, among other things, leaders of the Taliban insurgency have used Pakistan as a sanctuary. So it's very hard to think about policy in Afghanistan without thinking about what to do about the question of Pakistan as well.
We also asked Kugelman what Mr. Trump might be considering regarding Afghanistan, leaving U.S. troop levels where they are now, raising them, or even hiring contractors.
It's really hard to say. You know, this is clearly one of the most unpredictable presidencies that this country, the United States, has ever had. So my own gut feeling is that even after a very long, really an eight-month strategy review period, I imagine that the president will come out with a policy that will be very similar to what has been used by the Obama administration, which entails maintaining a modest U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, though I imagine that could entail sending several thousand more troops to enhance the current U.S. training mission of the Afghan security forces. But the thing is, with Trump, there could be a few surprises mixed in there as well. I imagine that there could be a plan to, for instance, look into ways to invest in the mineral reserves in Afghanistan. That's been something that had been suggested as a possible area for the Trump administration to look at.
On Sunday, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson, might have given a hint at what Mr. Trump's message might be when he praised the Afghan Special Operations Corps and said, "We are with you and we will stay with you."
Well, absolutely. And I think this is one of the major arguments for why the U.S. should maintain a military presence in Afghanistan. And that's because there has been significant progress with training the Afghan security forces, and particularly the special forces, who are very well trained, they're very efficient, they don't suffer from the same morale problems that the broader security forces do. And the U.S. Has really worried that these special forces, who number only about 12,000, are getting exhausted and overextended because they're being used in contexts where they shouldn't be used because the rest of the security forces don't do a good job. So I think that one could argue that by maintaining the U.S. training mission and perhaps expanding it by including several thousand more U.S. troops, you could then be in a position to increase the number of Afghan special forces, which would be a boon, certainly on the battlefield, but across the board it would be a good thing for Afghan security forces.
The Woodrow Wilson Center's Michael Kugelman also told us that the security situation in Afghanistan, in his words, is alarming, with the Taliban in control of more territory now than they have been at any time since U.S. troops went to Afghanistan well over a decade ago. Today, August 21st, will be the first time in 99 years that the entire United States will experience a solar eclipse. Optometrist B. Ralph Chu, who is a professor emeritus at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, also an accomplished astronomer, tells VOA what he expects with today's eclipse.
Even after seeing 18 total eclipses in my lifetime, it's still hard to predict how it's going to appear on the big day. But, you know, certainly one of the things that all of us eclipse chasers are going to be looking for is the appearance of the outer atmosphere of the sun, the corona, because unless you have specialized telescope equipment, you cannot see the corona normally outside of a total solar eclipse. So the appearance of the outer atmosphere of the sun is really something that's very attractive to us. You know, until the moon extinguishes the bright disk of the sun for that couple of minutes during total eclipse, we can only sort of guess at what it might look like. But whatever it's going to be really spectacular.
Just about everybody's saying that. And you might imagine that excitement is building across the U.S., with experts advising people to wear specific protective eyewear to view the eclipse. But as VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports right now, finding the special lenses, that's a difficult task.
The only thing Sarah McKnight found at the end of a traffic jam that snarled for blocks around Lagunitas Brewery was disappointment.
This did not work out for us today at all.
McKnight had traveled over 160 kilometers, not for beer, but rather the one thing that is becoming impossible to find anywhere in the Midwest United States. Protective lenses specifically designed to view the total solar eclipse.
Literally before we even pulled into the blocks, they were telling us they were gone.
Totally out.
The hottest thing out there right now is this cheap little piece of cardboard with
very, very specific lenses that are allowing you to gaze at the sun, see absolutely nothing other than the sun.
Sarah Cole is the Vice President of Guest Experiences at Chicago's Adler Planetarium, which sponsored the Eclipse Glasses giveaway at Lagunitas Brewery. The giveaway was scheduled to start at 12:30 p.m., with 1,000 glasses to hand out, for free, to those who showed up. Lines began forming at 4 a.m., and because the demand was so overwhelming, the giveaway started early and ended with many people leaving empty-handed.
Demand is incredibly, incredibly high, and I think that's the understatement of the century. We've gone through immense efforts to try and get as many of these out as possible, and I think we couldn't have even anticipated some of the challenges with keeping up with the demand that have been there.
Are you looking for glasses?
Yeah.
They're all out.
The Lagunitas giveaway was the last one sponsored by the Adler before the August 21st eclipse. Cole says they have handed out over 250,000 sets of solar lenses.
We thought that 250,000 should have us covered given all of the other ways that there would be to get eclipse glasses. But that's been the biggest challenge, is that a lot of those other ways of getting eclipse glasses have been compromised.
Demand has created a lucrative secondary market for the special lenses, mostly online, which was one of the only ways left, apart from Adler's giveaway events, to get them.
All stores are sold out. There is very little way to get them at this point.
Sold out, but necessary for eclipse viewing.
It is hugely important that people do not look at the sun without this sort of protection.
Which means if McKnight can't find a pair of the elusive glasses, she and her boys could miss out on a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
It feels like the Willy Wonka golden ticket. That's what it feels like. Everyone's like waving around, selling out. No chocolate bars, no chocolate bars. But somehow there's one golden ticket left, right? And they got it when they least expected it. So somewhere out there, there's some glasses left, and we might still find them.
The Adler does have some glasses left, reserved for last-minute distribution at the planetarium's viewing event on the day of the solar eclipse. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
We turn now to some sad news. Dick Gregory, who broke racial barriers in the 1960s and used his humor to spread messages of social justice as well as nutritional health, has died. He was 84. Gregory's son Christian said his father died late Saturday here in Washington, D.C., after being hospitalized for about a week. He had suffered a severe bacterial infection. Gregory was one of the first African-American comedians to find mainstream success with white audiences in the early 1960s. He rose from an impoverished childhood in St. Louis, Missouri, to become a celebrated satirist who commented upon racial divisions at the dawn of the civil rights movement. He spoke to a gathering of African-Americans in the U.S. city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in 2009.
Let me just say to the black family, I go from one end of the country to the other. I hear people talking about the family done broke down. And I say, well, something's wrong with that. We are the family. We never stole nobody, brought them away from their mother country, their family, their God, their language, and made them work for free. We are the family.
Gregory also got into politics when he ran for president in 1968 on the Peace and Freedom Party. He was their candidate. And Jerry Lewis, the comedy actor and showman who was widely known for his partnership with singer Dean Martin, settled down later on to become a self-conscious filmmaker and found an even greater following as the tireless host of the annual Muscular Dystrophy Telethons, has died. He passed away Sunday of natural causes at the age of 91 in Las Vegas, where his family was by his side. Lewis once spoke about what laughter means and how important it is.
Laughter is our safety valve. Laughter helps us get through Sarajevo. It helps us get through the stupid things that politicians do. Laughter is our secret, most important device, is to laugh.
Indeed, Jerry Lewis's career spanned the history of show business in the 20th century, beginning in his parents' vaudeville act at the age of 5. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
When many of us hear the word bacteria, we automatically think of nasty and dangerous little bugs that cause disease and suffering. But we also carry in our digestive system a good amount of what is considered good bacteria. These benevolent microbes actually help digest food and ensure food's nutrients are properly absorbed. They also help the immune system do its job of fighting off bad disease-carrying bacteria. A new study conducted by scientists at the University of Virginia suggests the use of antibiotics, which ironically were developed to fight bacterial infections, can actually interfere with our immune system's ability to protect us from disease by reducing the variety of our good bacteria. Details of the researchers' work and findings were published in the journal PLOS Pathogens. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Says VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In our report from the music department, the music of an American singer-songwriter and guitarist.
Been wondering why. Still, somehow, I believe we'd always survive. Now, I'm not so sure you're waiting to hear one good reason to try. But what more can I say? What's left to provide?
This is it. That's right. It's Kenny Loggins. And I know what you're thinking. Why Kenny Loggins? Well, I tell you what I'm thinking. Why not Kenny Loggins?
Don't be a fool anymore.
This is it.
The waiting is over. No room to run. No way to hide. No time for wonder.
Born in 1948, Kenneth Clark Loggins is an American singer-songwriter and guitarist. His early songwriting compositions were recorded with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band in 1970, which led to seven albums, performing as the group Loggins and Messina from 1972 to 1977. And as a solo artist, Loggins experienced a string of soundtrack successes, including an Academy Award nomination for Footloose in 1984. At the time that Kenny Loggins was at the top of his game, along came another rising superstar, Stevie Nicks, who was the lead singer of the group Fleetwood Mac and was even out on her own like Loggins. Whatever I Call You Friend was a big hit for Kenny Loggins and Stevie Nicks.
Hey.
I begin to think I understand. Anywhere we are, you and I have always been. Ever and ever, I see myself within your eyes. And that's all I need to show the world. Everything I do always takes me home.
Kenny Loggins, like Stevie Nicks and many others from that era, still take to the stage, and they're out this summer touring. Kenny's all over the place, making lots of lifelong fans very happy. Friends are important, especially if it's Stevie Nicks, don't you think? Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now a bit more from Stevie Nicks and Kenny Loggins.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Famine Early Warning Systems Network, or FuseNet, a U.S. government-funded provider of information and analysis on food insecurity, is signaling that the hunger and nutrition situation in southeastern Ethiopia is deteriorating, with numerous households in the drought-ridden Somali regional state already experiencing severe food insecurity. Likewise in Kenya, although the situation is not as dire, insufficient March to May rainfall has left people living in the country's arid and semi-arid regions at risk of crisis-level food insecurity in the near future. In 2011, the Horn of Africa suffered one of the worst droughts on record. The next few years saw subpar rainfall, which means that the hardest-hit regions did not have the chance to recover, either for growing grain or replenishing pasturage. Then came the 2015-2016 season and the abnormally warm El Niño phase of the global weather pattern. As a result, the most fragile regions in the arid Horn of Africa once again saw the deterioration of agricultural and livestock production, rising food prices, and a future wrought with hunger, malnutrition, and resulting diseases. Today, 7.8 million Ethiopians are suffering acute food insecurity, as are 2.6 million Kenyans. That is why the United States announced in early August that it will deliver more than $169 million worth of humanitarian aid for Ethiopia and Kenya. In doing so, the United States is scaling up emergency food assistance. The funds will provide such necessities as specialized nutrition supplies to treat malnourished children, safe drinking water, and essential health services. In Ethiopia, this assistance will provide food aid for about 3 million people. In addition to aid for Kenyans affected by the drought,